The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie doke. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, again here at a live show, March 2nd, 2003, here in the studios at Campbell Hall on the University of Illinois campus. One of the big themes that has come up over the last year since we started doing Media Matters has been the question of liberal media. Many of our guests have spoken about it, and we've had many callers calling, both pro and con, talking about, does the news media in the United States, or the media writ large, but especially the news media, have a bias towards liberal politicians, meaning specifically Democrats, the Democratic Party, and a hostility towards non-liberals, especially conservatives and representatives of the Republican Party. It is one of the big themes in the public debate and discussion of media in this country, and therefore an important theme for our show, Media Matters, to take up. Joining us today will be a guest who has discussed this issue at length in a brand new book called What Liberal Media? The Truth About the Bias in the News, that has just come out, published by Basic Books. And our guest is the author, Eric Alterman. Eric, you there?
I'm here.
Thank you so much for joining us. Eric Alterman is the media columnist for The Nation and MSNBC.com. He's written for Rolling Stone, Mother Jones, and the World Policy Journal. You're also an affiliated faculty member in the magazine journalism program at New York University, it says here.
I am.
You are indeed. And as I said, probably best known for your work at MSNBC and The Nation, and the author of the brand new book, What Liberal Media? The Truth About Bias in the News. Thank you so much for joining us, Eric.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Well, let's get right down to it. On Friday, the Gallup poll released a new survey of Americans. I don't know if you saw it, but it said that 45% of Americans believe the news media have a liberal bias, that they're, and that only, I think it was 13 or 14% believe the news media have a bias towards conservatives, that they're, what does that say to you? Does that mean, does that prove it? Does that establish that, in fact, the news media do indeed have a liberal bias?
Well, if you took your, if you judge reality by what people think, then it would be true if you lived in many Arab countries that if you blow yourself up in Tel Aviv, you'll be visited upon by 72 virgins. No, it doesn't prove anything. What it proves is that the conservatives have been extremely successful in perpetuating this notion and in using the media to do it. And in fact, much of the media believes it true, and so do even many liberals. But the fact that people believe something doesn't make it true, and this isn't true.
Now, what? Where did this liberal media idea come from? I mean, if it is so prevalent today, I mean, I'm a historian of media in this country, and certainly in the time of the Founding Fathers of the Civil War, or even in the Progressive Era, I mean, for most of American history, there was not an argument that our news media had a liberal bias. If you were to go to Canada or Britain, two countries very similar to the United States culturally and politically, there really isn't a notion of the news media having a liberal bias. Yet it seems to be a very prominent theme here. What's the origins of this this notion, and why is it so prominent here relative to other countries?
Well, you know, I think it was probably true. In fact, I think it was certainly true. And for much of the second half of the 20th century, in the late 40s, early 50s, and the 60s, right up through the 1970s, I think the media were biased against conservatives. I think there was a liberal consensus, a very narrow liberal consensus, but a liberal consensus nevertheless, and that conservatives like Barry Goldwater did have a very hard time getting their ideas across to the rest of the world because there was a filter which treated their views with derision and contempt. And I think this began to change in part because conservatives figured it out. I think Richard Mellon Scaife, the billionaire, might have been the first. And he started, after Goldwater got creamed in 1964, he started building up conservative institutions and conservative media and conservative intellectuals. And Irving Kristol and Robert Bartley, the Wall Street Journal, did the same thing. They went to Wall Street and they said, these radicals have taken over the media and the universities and the teaching professions, and if you don't fight back, you're not going to be able to make a living in this country anymore. And that worked. And so you got hundreds of millions of dollars brought together to build up an alternative conservative media structure. Now, this had two effects. One is that a lot of people now can live their life entirely inside a conservative media cocoon without ever hearing a liberal idea or even a centrist idea. The other thing is that it had a gravitational pull on the mainstream media. But the mainstream media became more conservative as a result. And finally, liberalism itself didn't weather the 1970s very well. The Vietnam War was a liberal war in its origin. The civil rights movement imploded, and it didn't leave much to work within its wake. It certainly achieved a great deal, but it didn't look very good in the 1970s when the more moderate voices like Martin Luther King had already been drowned out before his death by black power voices who were not interested in integration or accommodation with the white power structure. U.S. foreign policy looked weak to people, just a sort of man on the street, as a result of the Iranian hostage crisis and the Afghanistan, the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. And a lot of liberals lost their nerve. They lost their faith. They either moved to the left or to the right. There wasn't really anybody speaking out for liberalism. So by the end of the, by the beginning of the 1980s, when Ronald Reagan was elected, there was a whole conservative media structure. There was the media looking to move to the right because that's where all the energy and excitement was. And there was really no one to speak for liberals. And things have gotten... Should I continue? Or
yeah, go ahead. You're doing fine. This is public radio, so we don't have to pause for commercials.
All right. No, I just don't... You know, I talk forever. I can talk forever about this.
You would make a good professor.
Yeah. Well, I just got my doctorate two months ago. So.
Yeah, I saw that. Congratulations.
Thank you. So, you know, if anybody's out there wants to offer me a professorship, I'd be... you know where to find me. But anyway... but you see, the conservatives, who had a case, I think, a pretty good case, in the 60s and 70s, they found that this beating up on the media was so effective that they stuck to it even after they won. They call it working the refs. And I quote the former chairman of the Republican Party, Rich Bond, saying that they know that the media aren't liberal anymore, but this is such a great tactic, they have to stick with it. And I think that's the case now. I think the smart ones probably know that the media are just as conservative as they are liberal. In fact, are more conservative if you include the opinion media, which is silly not to include. But it's such a useful tactic that they stick with it. I don't blame them.
We're talking to Eric Alterman, Dr. Eric Alterman, the Nation columnist and the author of the new book, What Liberal Media, The Truth About Bias in the News, just published by Basic Books. He's our guest today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is a call-in show. If you'd like to call in and ask Eric Alterman a question, the number is 333-9455 or the toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Eric, you know, one of the core parts of the argument about the liberal media deals with the fact that journalists are liberals. I mean, journalists have all the power. I mean, it's an argument that doesn't really stress the commercial basis of the industry or the corporate structure of who owns and operates the news media, but really emphasizes that editors and journalists are the ones who are the key players in determining the shape of the news and that they are liberals. Now, the evidence here, I'd be interested in your take. I've seen surveys, for example, from 1992 of the Washington Press Corps, which came up with really an astronomical figure, something like 90% of the journalists voted for Bill Clinton that they were surveyed. Are you familiar with that survey?
Yes, sure. I deconstruct that survey in the book.
So,
in fact, I don't. I borrow someone else's deconstruction, the journalist Robert Perry.
But, you know, it's a powerful, you're saying, wow, 90% of the journalists voted for someone who only got 42% of the, or 44% of the popular vote.
The figure that they use is 89%.
Okay,
it's
go ahead, deconstruct away.
It's a bad survey. It doesn't tell us very much. First of all, the response rate was very low. So it's they sent out 400-something letters. They only got about 130 response. That's not good enough. You can't do a survey with such a small response rate. Second of all, they got the wrong 130 people. They did the survey of the congressional people who are the congressional reporters, which leaves out an awful lot of the most important pundits. In fact, it leaves out an awful lot of the conservatives who work for nonprofits, like National Review or Weekly Standard, and the people who go on television, and it overweights people who have no voice in national affairs, people who work for very small or medium-sized newspapers, but nobody ever hears of them outside of their circulation. And so it doesn't end up telling you anything about, I mean, the thing is the 89 figure is a bad figure. Did most journalists vote for Bill Clinton in 1992? I imagine they did. Why? Well, Clinton, first of all, if you're a journalist, for merely professional reasons, you didn't want to have four more years of Reagan-Bush. 12 was more than enough. There was no stories to be left to be done. the Bush people weren't any fun to begin with. The Clinton people were a lot of fun. They're just like journalists. They're the same kind of people. Democrats are more fun to cover than Republicans. Journalists are tougher on them, in part for that reason, but they're more fun. They leak a lot. They can't agree on anything. They fight with each other. They're never very well organized. But, you know, look, Clinton's politics were socially liberal and economically conservative. That's the politics of most journalists. They are social liberals, no doubt about it. Everybody I know has the same positions on social issues, you know, on the Upper West Side here where I live. But they're also to the right of the country economically. And on the social issues where journalists are liberals, there's this whole right-wing structure, pressure, to keep journalists in line from giving voice to their opinions. And there's also the tradition of professionalism, of objectivity, where they try to denude themselves of these positions. On the economic side, where journalists are more conservative than the rest of the country, there's nothing. The only thing that's pushing them on that side is the corporate interests of their owners. And with only six companies owning most of the media in the United States, that's pushing them to the right as well. So the very structure of the economic news we receive is conservative economic news. You can listen to NPR all day. You're never going to hear a show called Labor Watch. You're going to hear Market Watch. You're going to get the stock market prices all day. You're not going to hear about wage conditions in Vietnam. You're not going to hear about environmental pollution. You might hear about it a little, but it's not a basic pillar of reporting. When you hear a stock price going up, you don't hear about whether or not that went up because of wages being cut or pollution controls being loosened or jobs being outsourced to the third world and, you know, and those workers not being allowed the right to organize. You don't hear about any of that. That's defined as that would be biased news. That would be liberal bias if you reported on it. So even on NPR, the great beacon of the left in this country, supposedly, or PBS, where you have Fortune doing its own program replacing Louis Rukeyser, you've got a very conservative definition of news insofar as economics goes. And that's, to me, an accurate reflection of both journalists' views and the way that corporate media structure reinforces them. You don't really see journalists' views being reported in social issues because they're so sensitive to the accusation of liberal bias.
We're talking to Eric Alterman, the columnist for The Nation, and the author of the new book, What Liberal Media? The Truth About Bias in the News, today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. If you'd like to call in, we have phone lines open. The local number is 333-9455, the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. We do have someone here ready to go on line one. Urbana, you're on the air with Eric Alterman.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. And I had two things that I just wanted to hear Eric Alterman and Bob McChesney's comments on, and that is a little bit about Bernard Goldberg. Who is he? And, you know, sort of what's his sort of pedigree? He's a guy that wrote the book Bias, I think. And then the other thing is just if you could say a little bit about NPR, because, you know, I have to agree with you in that sense of the media. I mean, it does seem to have sort of a, I guess what would be called a basic sort of liberal social outlook, but I don't know. I find it almost laughable to call it leftist because of both, like, I don't know, I find on economic matters and political and foreign policy, it seems extremely conservative. So I'll hang up and listen to your comments. Thanks.
And Eric, before you jump in on that, I should add that the subtitle of your book, The Truth About Bias in the News, I assume is in part a reference to the Goldberg book entitled Bias.
Yeah.
So for listeners of ours who probably aren't familiar with Bernard Goldberg's book, why don't you just give a brief précis of that and then answer the question?
Well, the one thing I can say about Bernard Goldberg's book is that it's not as bad as Ann Coulter's book.
That's high praise.
Yeah. That's about the only nice thing I can say about it. Bernard Goldberg was a CBS producer who almost everybody knows who pays attention to this issue by now. He got in some hot water, not too much hot water, just a little bit of hot water, because he attacked his boss on the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal. And he ended up having to move his job from working for Dan Rather in the Evening News, where he'd been for a long time, to working in a different part of CBS News. I think 60 Minutes, too, is where he ended up. And he wrote this incredibly whiny book about how persecuted he was as a result of his conservative views and saying that he had been whacked like Big Pussy on The Sopranos, comparing getting to serve out his pension at 60 Minutes, too, to being murdered. It's a silly book. It has Dan Rather's name in it 72 times. And the facts, it has no research. It has no empirical basis. If you ask him to support any of it, he can't do it. Doesn't even try. I publish in the appendix of my, the appendices of my book, which are available on the web, and only on the web, actually, at www.whatliberalmedia.com. I published some of the research that's been done into some of the claims that Goldberg made, claims that were accepted quite widely across the media that are just false. And again, he can't support any of them. He doesn't even try. So this book was an enormous bestseller and cause celeb for Goldberg. It sold almost 500,000 copies in hardcover. Now it's on the bestseller list in paperback. And it's just crap. And it's an indication of how lazy the media are and how cowed they are by the right that any of his claims at all were accepted and embraced. I quote one of the reviews in the book by the dean of the Columbia Journalism School in Columbia Journalism Review. It's a critical review, but it accepts one of the claims, which is that liberals get labeled more often than conservatives. And that, too, is just crap. That's one of the things that's taken apart by the linguist Jeffrey Nunberg, and you can read that on the appendix in my website.
Now, you were saying, though, that as bad as the Goldberg book is, you've characterized it as crap. It is superior to the Ann Coulter book. Now, Ann Coulter's book, is at least one caller to the show has pointed out, has, unlike Goldberg's book, page after page of footnotes to support her claims. Isn't that true?
Yeah, but they're lies. The footnotes are themselves lies and frequently slander. You can't believe her footnotes, and in fact, one of my other appendices is a very long list of stuff called Fact Checking Ann Coulter, done by CAPT, the website for the American Prospect magazine, and a lot of her footnotes are just nonsense. So it has the costume. It's costumed with footnotes, but the footnotes don't hold up. Just give you one tiny example that I saw when I was reading it. She says that Jonathan Alter of Newsweek criticized her conservative books because his books don't sell. Jonathan Alter's never written a book. So, I mean, I know it. I know Jonathan Alter's never written a book. I would know if he had written a book. So I look up the footnote, and she lists one of those Newsweek election books that has like 12 people's names on them, because those were the people who whose work was collected, you know, and republished at the end of the election. And that's her accusation, that Alter had written a book. It's silly. It's childish. I suppose in some universe it's technically true, but it's deliberately misleading. And I think that's the case with an awful lot of what she says.
We're talking to Eric Alterman, the author of the new book, What Liberal Media Today and Media Matters. The phone lines are open. We've got a couple people waiting I'm going to get to, but if you'd like to call in, the number is 333-9455, the toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. And let's go to the phone lines. Line 4, Chicago car phone, you're on the air.
Hi, this is Keith Lee. I believe earlier in the program there was a comment that there are about 6 large media companies that control the majority of the media in the U.S. I was wondering if you could characterize the ownership of those 6 companies, and specifically who has the majority and controlling ownership in those, please?
Well, I think, Bob, you can do a better job of that than I can. I think I relied on your research for this. So I take a break. And
I hope Ann Coulter doesn't fact check you.
Go ahead. You answer this one.
Well, you know, I'll defer on that then and let people go to my website and look at stuff, because I'd really rather have this hour go for you to talk, Eric, and discuss
it. I mean, there are 6 companies, and I think AOL Time Warner is the largest. And then there's Bertelsmann and Disney and NBC.
What I would say for listeners who just want to get a thumbnail on this, the Columbia Journalism Review has if you go to their website, which is easy to find, they've got a lot of material on who owns what, and it's laid out in a very easy way to follow. Also, Fairness and Action Reporting, their website, fair.org, has links to material like this. And we'll do shows in the future where we'll spend a whole hour going over the companies and what they own. But today, let's really focus.
Okay. But, you know, it is important to remember that this ownership structure doesn't push journalists in the direction of liberalism. You know, you don't want to get your boss in trouble. That's not going to make him happy. So the idea is to ignore as much as you can of the kinds of companies that kinds of stories that might embarrass your company. And if your company owns 150 other media companies, then that's a lot of stories to ignore.
Yeah, and I think that's the crucial point. The argument that the media have a liberal bias is predicated on looking at journalists, not owners, and sort of the role of owners tends to fall by the wayside.
Right.
And because when they're the more they're brought into the picture, the more that argument doesn't really look very convincing, because very few of the people who own news media would be characterized as liberals, certainly not economic liberals, and even social liberals often they are not as well. Our phone lines are heating up here, so let's go back to them. Line one, Urbana, you're on the – or line one, Champagne, you're on the air with Eric Alterman.
Hi. Well, as long as you're talking about books, I'm very curious about the author of the book Blinded by the Right. His name is Brock, and I read his book and was, you know, just absolutely overwhelmed by the information he put out. And, you know, if he is to be believed, there's actually a right-wing conspiracy in terms of the media and everything else, but this is a man who is actually, you know, laying bare the fact that he lied for 10, 15 years when he was writing. Who knows if you can believe him now? And I'm just curious if you can shed any light on this.
Yeah, and Eric, again, before you answer that, if you could maybe give a brief summary of Brock and his book for listeners who might not be familiar with him.
Yeah. I'm working hard here doing all these book reports.
I know. Well, you're a PhD. This is what you have to do.
No, I got the PhD, so I don't have to do it anymore.
Okay.
Yeah, David Brock, he was kind of this right-wing hitman, very successful right-wing hitman, who wrote a book about Anita Hill that said she all kinds of terrible things about her, and then got $1 million from a publisher to write one about Hillary Clinton, and it turned out that he didn't get anything on her, and his friends didn't like that, and they turned on him, and so also he's gay, and that was kind of uncomfortable for him. So eventually he switched sides in a rather gradual process, and he wrote a tell-all book about the right, in which he says all kinds of horrible things about these people, like, you know, Ann Coulter is an anti-Semite, and John Podhoretz is a homophobe, and they all put him up to lying, and they didn't care about whether or not any of the stuff they published about Bill Clinton was true, and there was all kind of financial shenanigans going on at the American Spectator with Richard Mellon's Gates Millions. And the problem with Brock is, he was a liar once, so it's easy to dismiss him again. Now, nobody has put any real holes in his story, and everything he said in this book seems to hold up. But it's hard to hang too much on him because you know what his past is. So I use him to sort of illustrate the structure of the right. I wouldn't call it a conspiracy. You could call it a conspiracy, but I think it's a mistake because you can see most of it up front. And when you say the word conspiracy in America, you sound like a nut whether or not there is a conspiracy. So I don't call it a conspiracy, and I wish Hillary Clinton hadn't called it a conspiracy. But he does show how it operates in a dishonest fashion that is much more the tactics of a political movement than what we think of as journalism. And that is revealed in this book, and a lot of reputations would suffer in this book if people were able to be certain that Brock is telling the truth, which, as I said, is not that easy.
Let's go to another phone call if we can. Line 2, Champaign County, you're on the air with Eric Alterman.
Hi. I wanted to engage you on this very issue of conspiracy and or institutional analysis, but I think I'd like to get at it by starting at how you were characterizing the media in the 60s and 70s as being, well, it was truly liberal then, and that Vietnam was a liberal war, and that it's true that it started under Kennedy, but Kennedy wasn't all that liberal. I mean, he's marshaled out by likes of Limbaugh with this.
Well, I don't get my history lessons from Rush.
Well, but you are analyzing the right and the way and he's actually right on that. Which
they marshaled out Franklin Delano Roosevelt too. Who cares what they say?
I'm sorry, I threw his name in because it obviously hit a hot button with you. But
it's not a hot button. It's a non-point to say Rush Limbaugh quotes the guy, and therefore he's not a liberal.
Well, what he's quoting is accurate, which is that he said, how is it? Boats. He did tax cuts, in other words, and he said that.
Why are tax cuts not liberal?
Because when
what
you
if they when worked.
You,
they were a successful economic stimulus.
No, no. Well, I have a lot of problems with you then, but let's go back to the fact that the media was not that particularly liberal in the 60s.
Compared to what?
I think, well, they did endorse Nixon. As
who's the they?
They is the editorial boards of most of the dominant newspapers in the country. And I think Mr. McChesney, Professor McChesney, can back me up on that. So they were not that
liberal.
Well,
I don't think the fact that the owners of the newspapers, who are the people who are in charge of endorsements, were more Republican than Democrat, demonstrates that the media were not covering national politics from a narrowly liberal perspective.
Well, they were doing the same kind of self-censorship that they're doing now. So I'm saying that I think you were.
Well, that's an assertion without any evidence.
Well, what I'm asserting is, with evidence, is that there was no golden age when the media was particularly.
I didn't say it was a golden age, and I don't even think it was necessarily a good thing. I'm just saying that conservatives, like Goldwater, had a good case when they said they couldn't get their ideas across through the elite media because the elite media didn't take their ideas seriously. That's
well,
all I said.
Well, Goldwater was a terribly fringe conservative too. So
well, he was a Republican candidate for president.
Well, I know, but he was an incredibly
caller,
conservative.
Let's try to get to a question here if we can.
Well, I think this was illustrative of some things, though. That
what's illustrative is that I'm making certain statements that I believe I can back up with evidence, and those are the statements that I'm willing to defend.
Well, you
not
also
willing to defend statements you'd like to put in my mouth.
You also implied that college campuses were some kind of bastion of liberalism, whereas actually the opposition to the Vietnam War, and this is demonstrated by Chomsky in polls, at contemporaneous polls, that opposition on campuses only went against the war at a very late date, and that the academia in toto was very supportive of the war. So.
Well, you didn't disagree with anything I just said. I didn't say anything that would contradict that last statement. And B, I think I'm a better historian and a better meat analysis than Noam Chomsky. So whatever he said, you know, the fact that he says something doesn't necessarily make it true.
I was just letting you. Quoting his name, I wasn't invoking him as a god. I was just saying that he has the chapter and verse on the poll.
Well, what I said was, the statement you're referring to is my statement of Irving Kristol. It's Irving Kristol who I said went to corporate America and said to them, look, the media and the universities and the teaching professions have been taken over by leftists. And if you want to survive, you have to pony up a lot of money for our conservative think tanks. Now, that's not me talking. That's my characterization of Irving Kristol.
Okay, well, I missed the quotes. But the other thing is that by you citing SCAFE as so being so important in this whole process, it does sort of bring out this idea of conspiracy, whereas it is a whole institutional analysis. And I think you might have an earlier book on actually this network of think tanks, et cetera, which I think is productive. And I don't know why we hit it off as argumentative as it is, because I think I do agree with you on a lot. But
to be honest, I feel like you're taking what I'm saying out of context. That's why we're hitting it off as argumentative.
Well, this is the limitations of a talk show, maybe, because I don't think that. Sort of build on this whole image of the 60s as being entirely liberal, where at the same time it was socially liberal, but it was still, you made that same division, and I thought that was an important one for you to make between economically conservative and socially liberal, and that actually pertained to that time as well. So I guess I've taken this as far as I might, and I'll just let someone else have a question. Thank you.
Thank you. I would just say that whenever I speak, there's always people who say to me, You're not very liberal, and your whole idea of liberalism is silly. And what about, you know, the U.S. foreign policy in Guatemala, or you know, what about the fact that the poor are so much poorer than they should be? And in other words, that I'm constantly, and particularly at the Nation, because I am certainly the most conservative person at the Nation, now that Christopher Hitchens is gone. And my response to this is always compared to what? I mean, it's true. There are countries where the center of gravity is well to the left of the United States, and that there are lefts in those countries that have the effect, you know, like the Greens in Germany, that can have an effect on power in a way that a far left in this country cannot. But as long as we're talking about this country, then it seems to me that it makes sense to talk about liberal in that context. Now, in the book, I do point out that the center of our political gravity is well to the right of most of Western Europe, and in Western Europe, I would actually be a very respectable center-leftist. I wouldn't even be on the left side of the left. I would be very critical of it. I'd be an old-fashioned social democrat in Northern Europe. And also, I talk about the work of John Rawls, and I say this is really what liberalism is, and it's just off the table. It's considered so far left, it's utopian. And I blame the media, in part, for this, the fact that the media discourse is so constricted. But that's reality, and I accept reality. And so the reality in this country is that there's a very narrow parameter of debate that's possible. Now, in that context, the media were a great deal more liberal relative to the rest of the country in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s than they began to be in the 80s, 90s, and today. I don't find that statement so questionable or objectionable.
We're talking to Eric Alterman, the author of the new book, What Liberal Media? The Truth About Bias in the News, today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We have phone lines open if you'd like to call in. The number is 333-9455, and the toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. Eric, let's talk a little bit about the media environment that most Americans consume today. You referred to it at the beginning in your opening comments. Talk radio. What's your assessment of the political contribution of talk radio to our culture today?
Well, I think talk radio today has about the same degree of ideological diversity that the Soviet Communist Party did in 1934, maybe a little less. Talk radio, where the figure that I keep seeing is 40 million Americans say they get their news from talk radio. This is a terrifying number. Bill O'Reilly is genuinely a liberal by the standards of American talk radio, because he admits that global warming is taking place, although he doesn't think we should do anything about it. And he prefers, he thinks the death penalty is too kind, and he'd like to see prisoners punished more, and thinks death is too easy. Those are his two liberal positions, and that makes him a liberal.
But the argument that I hear when this point is raised is that they'll say, well, look, if listeners wanted to hear liberals, it would be in the interest of owners to put them in the air. So clearly the marketplace has voted that only conservatives can make money. They're the only one that generate the audience and therefore the financial support. And, that any self-interested firm would gladly put a Marxist on the air if they would make a profit off of them.
I basically agree with that argument.
And the argument goes to take that to cable television, where we've just seen in the past week the cancellation of the one liberal program on the air, the Donahue Show.
That show stunk. It was unwatchably bad, and it was very expensive to produce. I mean, my frustration is that the people they always choose to test this proposition are the wrong people. Mario Cuomo and Doug Wilder and Jerry Brown were bad talk radio hosts. Bill Donahue was a terrible cable TV talk show host. I think there's some good people out there. I'd like to see, I think Al Franken would be a true test of the market. There are not that many liberals who are good at demagoguery and cutting up and being funny and not being all that serious. Liberals are too serious. And so we haven't really tested this proposition, but clearly conservatives are much, much more effective at organizing themselves into a market and consuming media in such a way that the executives of these corporations notice than liberals do. Nobody watched Donahue. It's true that it did better than most of the other MSNBC shows, but it was more expensive to produce, and it was absolutely getting creamed by its competition. It was doing terrible compared to O'Reilly and to Connie Chung. So I don't really fault them for firing Donahue. I would just like to see somebody who can really give them a go be hired, somebody like Franken. I think he'd be a great talk show host. Or Jon Stewart. The problem is Janine Garofalo. The problem is I'm picking entertainers, I'm not picking political people, and that's part of the problem with liberalism, with liberals today, as much as it is the fault of the media.
I mean, in the sense that there aren't liberal thinkers who can be entertaining, unless they're entertainers to begin with?
Right, right. I also think that, conservatives have a real movement. They're organized in all different kinds of ways, and O'Reilly... He's on twice a night now. He gets something like 4 or 5 million viewers if you add them all up. There's nothing like that on the liberal side, nothing at all.
Okay, we're talking to Eric Alterman, the author of What Liberal Media. Let's go back to the phone lines. Line one, Champagne, you're on the air.
Yeah, we've been kind of skirting around perhaps this topic of what can't be said or what is unsaid or the fact that there's a narrow band of what can be said in the States, which is very different from what can be said in Europe or France or England or Germany. And I just was wondering if you could kind of talk about that. I don't know whether you talk about it in terms of ideology or discourse analysis or what. You know, you said that, you know, this is what listeners want. You know, that's what that's what they get. Is that because they don't want to be challenged, that they just want to have their images of themselves reaffirmed, and that they want to remain isolationist and racist? Or can you address that in any way?
Well, I think it's a chicken and egg proposition, and it's an insoluble one in my view. It's laid out for me in a very good book by a political scientist named Robert Antonin called Democracy Without Citizens that was published by Oxford University Press in the 1990s, I believe.
1989.
And he says that, you know, people can't demand, you can't be a good citizen if you don't have access to complicated, demanding information that takes a long time to understand and to assimilate.
Mm-hmm.
But no media company can afford to provide that if there's no market for it. And yet, you don't know that you need it unless you have access to it in the first place.
And maybe our educational system might point that out to people in some way?
Well, this fixing problems of politics by education, you know, that goes back to Jefferson, if not earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just never worked. I mean, it's the basic Deweyite ideology of liberalism, and I subscribe to it, but I don't subscribe to it with a great deal of optimism, because we've just never, the mass of people has never, ever been able to be educated to this, to the level that I think would satisfy you.
But it seems to be going in the opposite direction, to less and less. Like, people aren't aware that there were any negative effects to sanctions in Iraq, or you'll have college students who don't really know what Palestine and Israel are arguing about, or that they're actually even fighting over the same territory.
Yeah, well, that's just always the way it's been. It's always the way it's been in this country. And there are a couple of things that are different now. One is that the information is available through the Internet.
Right.
If you want it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still a lot of work to get it. I mean, I spend all day doing it. It's my job.
Right.
So I get it. But most people don't have all day. They don't even have much more than an hour. And they don't want to spend their time doing that. They want to do what they want to do. So you can't rely on them to get the information themselves. Now, since you bring up college students, I will say that I am, you know, I spend just as much time in universities as I do in the media, because I spent 11 years getting my doctorate, and I got a master's before that. And I have to say, I'm very dispirited by what's happened to the universities. That the universities are genuinely leftist places. They are. The center of gravity is a left-wing center of gravity. I am a conservative in most universities because I'm a liberal. But I'm very critical of what's happened, not because they're leftist. You can be a leftist if you want. I'm fine with that. I think, you know, every political movement needs a radical side to it to push it and to give it some guts. But they've basically taken themselves out of national politics, most of the leftists in the universities. In the 50s and the 60s, they were playing on the same field as the rest of us, and they were important articulate force.
Now they've zoomed off into theory.
Right, theory and these very difficult, narrow, specialized notions that have nothing to do with anything that has an impact on the lives of people that they profess to care about. And so these people are left without any articulate defense. And I try and do it in the nation, but even in the nation, it's not that easy to do because everybody's so interested in identity politics and offshoots of academic theory, many of which, you know, derive from Foucault and Derrida, that are very interesting, but they don't seem to have much to do with sort of narrowing the gap between rich and poor.
Or communicating.
Or getting resources for the people who need them. So I have to say, I think that leftists are to blame for much of their own impotence in this country. And I wish, there's been sort of a movement among historians in recent years, which is the field I'm most familiar with, to write better. And I think that's great. My model of a engaged intellectual would be somebody like Alan Brinkley, who is a very good historian at Columbia University, chairman of the department. But he's always writing in places like the New York Times and Slate and the New Republic and the Nation and the American Prospect. And he's bringing to bear his knowledge in a way that people who don't have degrees, who aren't steeped in the debates of the university, can understand. And in history there's more of these people than there are in other fields. There used to be a whole sort of series of economists who did this, John Kenneth Galbraith being the archetype. But we've lost these people by and large, and it's a terrible loss, and it's our own fault.
Eric, let's go back to the phone lines if we can. We're talking to Eric Alterman. The number here is 333-9455, the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. We've had a caller who's been very patient. Line 2, Urbana, you're on the air with Eric Alterman.
Yes, thanks. My question is basically that, you know, when we talk about the Gadanyu, for example, you know, he was given, 6 months to develop an audience and, you know, make a profit, blah, blah, blah. And, of course, he gets canned even though he's making the most money, you know.
Now, he was losing money.
Well, he was losing money.
He was having the highest ratings, but he was still losing more money because the show was so...
But wasn't it true he was the most popular program on that network?
Yeah, but that's not the point. The point is to make money. And he was losing more money than the other guys were losing because their shows weren't as expensive to produce.
Yeah, but... Okay.
But what? It's a for-profit enterprise.
Hold on.
Donahue is the guy who's losing the most money. They were right to can him.
Now, but, Erica, how solid? I'm just curious.
Guys, that's not even my question.
Okay.
I want to get to my real question.
Sure, go ahead.
Thank you. How long did it take the right-wing radio, maybe going back to the 60s, to become as popular as it is? Because my contention is, well, that didn't happen overnight, so let's give left-wing radio years and years of support to become as popular. And I'll just hang up and listen to your response.
Well, my response is that conservatives are the ones who gave conservative radio the opportunity to prosper. So it's up to liberals to give liberal radio the opportunity to prosper. And if there are liberal billionaires out there who want to subsidize it or start their own cable networks, then great. Rupert Murdoch is willing to subsidize his newspapers, and he was willing to subsidize his magazines, and he was willing to subsidize his TV station until he didn't need to anymore. Now it's profitable. But liberals, they're not doing that. These are conservative victories that were won fairly. And this notion that Donahue was cut off too early, maybe he was, but I'm telling you, I couldn't watch the damn thing. I'm not willing to go to the mat for a show that was unwatchable.
You know, one thing about the Donahue show that has come out, and I happen to be good friends with one of the producers there, you know, a couple months ago, MSNBC sort of issued a directive to the show that they didn't want it to appear too liberal. So there was the last 2 months or so, the guest slate always had to be what they called balanced, but a standard which really no other show on television, to my knowledge, was sort of formally held to keep, where there were many conservatives always had to be there, and the host was considered on the far left. And it sort of changed the tenor of the show, made it much more difficult for Donahue to sort of advocate what would be a liberal political view because he had all these rabid right-wingers on sort of who got to set the agenda. I mean, how much of that handcuffing do you think hurt Donahue's ability to find a liberal voice?
Well, I haven't seen this story in a forum that I know it's true. I've seen it written up in a kind of anonymous fashion. And I don't know where the sources are. I don't know exactly what happened. It sounds like it might be true, and you're saying that you have a friend who's a producer there, and he's saying it's true.
Yeah, no, it's true.
Yeah, well...
And if you watched the show, you could see it was true. You could see how it had changed the last few months.
You know, I only watched the show a couple times, and every time I did it, it was the same. It was just like Donahue was doing that old show that he did about social dysfunction. But he was dealing with important issues, and he couldn't get to the bottom of anything. I never went on the show. I was only invited once for a media bias show, and I didn't go because my book wasn't out yet. And I watched that show, and it was terrible. It had two liberals. You had Mario Cuomo and Al Franken on with Bernard Goldberg. And he wasn't getting to the bottom of anything. He was doing what you're saying he was doing, which is just sort of letting the right and the left fight it out. I think that's the... It's possible that someone at NBC got nervous about the fact that we were going to war and didn't want to be out there on the left with this show. But I also think that it just really wasn't working. I mean, it was expensive and it was a pain, and it wasn't justified by the numbers. Now, you could say if they had a real commitment to ideological diversity on cable TV, they would have stuck with it longer and taken the losses and given it a chance. They didn't have that commitment. That's true. They don't have a commitment to ideological diversity. They lost Donahue and they hired three right-wingers to replace him. They couldn't care less about any less. They care about profits. And my argument is if liberals want their own media, they have to make it profitable.
We're talking to Eric Alterman, the author of What Liberal Media, today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. The phone lines are open. We have time for a couple more calls. 333-9455 is the local number. Let's go back to the phone lines. Line one, Charleston, you're on the air with Eric Alterman.
Hi. I just had a question about some of the things you said earlier about attempts to get liberal views on the radio. And you mentioned Al Franken and said there just weren't a whole lot of liberals who were entertaining demagogues. And I guess I beg to differ, and I have a question about it. Seems to me you have Molly Ivins and Jim Hightower and Michael Moore, all kinds of people who, at least as far as I can see, are good, you know, populist demagogues. And I believe that Jim Hightower had a radio show, although I never got to listen to it. I wonder if you had any comment about, you know, what happened with that.
Actually, that was the very first column I wrote for The Nation when I started doing this about, I do think Jim Hightower was censored by his corporate parent, and that's why his radio show was taken off. That's the one example I grant that wasn't a market thing. His network was bought by Disney. He had been beaten up on Michael Eisner, and they cut him off when he was growing. I also think
that was back in 1995.
Yeah, okay. And I do think, I'm basically in agreement with you. I think all those people you mentioned would be great. Molly, I love her. Michael Moore, I don't really like him, but he'd be good.
Why don't you like Michael Moore, if I can ask?
He's just too demagogic for my taste.
Mm-hmm.
I prefer someone who, I mean, even Al Franken is he says things. Michael Moore says things that I think are just so, they're so gross, they're no longer true. They might be motivated on the correct side of things, generally speaking, but he's so careless about how he puts them that they end up not being true. I mean, he said, you know, isn't it, I think he said this, unless he's being flattered, he said that it's really terrible that they attacked New York because those were the Gore voters and not the Bush voters after 9/11. It seemed a really silly thing to say.
Yeah, I haven't seen that quote anywhere. That's, yeah, I'd like to see that.
Yeah, well, I'm not standing by it, but I've
seen it doesn't stop you from saying it, though.
Well, no, I actually am pretty sure he said it.
Okay.
But I'm not saying I'm 100% sure he said it.
Okay.
I thought his support for Ralph Nader up until the very end of the election was also irresponsible, given where it was clearly leading and where it in fact led. But anyway, I don't mind. You know, if you're going to do talk radio, you're going to have your irresponsible people. So I'm all for it. I'm not the right person to do it myself. I would like to see this tested. I would like to see whether or not the very people that the gentleman mentioned can build a populist following. God knows liberals on the left need a stronger populist following in this country. They're getting killed in this really crucial arena. 40 million people watching, listening to, getting the news from talk radio, 15 to 20 million people alone listening to Limbaugh every day. And there are a lot of little Limbaughs out there. So I'm all for it, and I'd like to see it tested. But, you know, it's clear that the test is coming from someone who's on the liberal side ideologically. It's not a market-driven thing. There's no market crying out for a liberal voice. And that's, you know, let's hope it works. But there's no indication that it will from a market standpoint, and that's ultimately going to give the final word on it.
We've only got a couple minutes left, and let's go back to the phone lines. We have two callers who have been waiting patiently. Line 2, Urbana, you're on the air with Eric Alterman.
Well, I would like to raise the question of economic forces dictating that the media giants would have to do what is profitable. And it seems to me that news and public affairs are such a small part of their income stream that they can very well ignore the profit motive, and that they do. That they're much more interested in their own ideological interests.
Well, you see, but I think their ideological interests are not as far to the right as these shows. I mean, I think Limbaugh is a really nutty, reactionary guy who wouldn't be invited to dinner at the heads of these corporations. They might invite him once because he's entertaining, but he's not their kind of guy. These corporate guys are moderate conservatives, and they're actually social liberals in most cases. And yet they know that the conservative movement is where the people who are engaged in politics are right now, and the people who are willing to spend all their time listening to talk radio and watching cable TV. So I do think that every once in a while there's an instance of corporate censorship, like with Disney. It's happened a few times, and maybe with GE on nuclear power issues. But that doesn't happen all that often. I think the corporations are comfortable with a center-right discourse, and they're willing to tolerate a far-right discourse. They might be less comfortable with a center-left discourse, much less a leftist discourse. But I think if it were really profitable, they would do it anyway, just the way they're doing with the far-right discourse.
Let's go back to the phone lines, Eric, because we're almost out of time here. Line 1, Champagne, you're on the air with Eric Alterman.
Hi. You've been talking mostly about commentators. I missed the beginning, so you might have brought this up. But certainly it seems to me that NPR, in terms of news, has a left or liberal bias. Let's go even further. Associated Press, as a major source of information in this country, has a left bias.
Why do you say that?
Why? Because if you look at the way they report material, and if you look at who owns Associated Press.
Who owns it, and what way do they report material?
You
I don't know
me,
what you're talking about.
Well, you tell me who owns Associated
Press. I asked you.
Well, as far as I know, it's owned by Middle East sources.
What are you talking about?
Associated Press has been bought out by corporations that are owned by, to a certain extent, by Saudi and other
liberal groups.
Is this true? Do you know this?
No, Associated Press
is talking about UPI.
Yeah, Associated Press is a cooperative owned by the major newspapers.
Okay, so what am I talking about? UPI?
Talking about UPI, which has very, very few subscribers and has basically fallen apart and barely exists anymore.
Uh-huh.
And these Middle Eastern sources, I think they're Baha'i people.
Okay.
People
well, that's
Baha'i,
Middle Eastern, isn't it?
So it sounds to me like you've got a conspiracy theory without much to hang it on, sir.
No. Isn't it true that NPR has a liberal bias?
Well, no, it's not true that it has a liberal bias. It's true that most people who work at NPR are either liberals or they don't have politics at all. They're just journalists. They're not many conservatives at NPR. But there are an awful lot of conservatives on the air at NPR. They get much more of a voice than they do on, say, Fox News. And also, NPR tries to tell the story straight as best as they can. And when they don't, they hear about it and they try and address it. They're not nakedly ideological the way Fox News is, the way the New York Post is, the way the Wall Street Journal editorial page is, the way the Washington Times is.
Eric Alterman, I'm afraid the band is tuning up in the background, which means they're forcing me out of the studio.
Okay.
I've got to thank you very much, Eric Alterman, for being our guest today. Eric Alterman is the columnist for The Nation magazine and the author of the new book, What Liberal Media? The Truth and Bias About the News. I'm Bob McChesney. You've been listening to Media Matters. We'll be back one week from today with Mark Weisbrod as our guest, talking about the coverage of the economy in the news media. And I'd like to thank Ben Scott, my wonderful producer, for all his great work. See you in 160.